For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome back to this special two-hour edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up later, Stuart Turton takes us on a mysterious and murderous voyage in his new novel, The Devil and the Dark Water. We hear the heartwarming story of how an RNIB volunteer, an internationally renowned musician, and a Holocaust survivor came together to create a talking book. The RNIB Library's Lynn Livingston gives us her literary antidote to lockdown. Best-selling novelist Sarah Morgan transports us to the Lake District in search of family harmony. And S.D. Robertson shares the books of his life. But first, back in January, long before he shattered his ankle, Robert Kirkwood spoke to the winner of the Costa First Novel Award.
The Costa First Novel Award has been won by Sarah Collins for her debut, The Confessions of Franny Langton, following the fortunes of a Jamaican maid in Georgian London and inspired by Sarah's love of Gothic fiction. Sarah will join me in a moment, but first, let's hear a clip. The audiobook is narrated by Sarah herself, along with Roy McMillan.
My trial starts the way my life did, a squall of elbows and shoving and spit. From the prisoner's hold, they take me through the gallery, down the stairs, and past the table crawling with barristers and clerks. Around me a river of faces in flood, their mutters rising, blending with the lawyers' whispers. A noise that hums with all the spite of bees in a bush. Heads turn as I enter, every eye a skewer. I duck my head, parrot my boots, grip my hands to stop their awful trembling. It seems all of London is here, but then murder is the story this city likes best.
The book is about Franny, who is a young Jamaican woman who is brought to London in the early 19th century by her owner, John Langton, and given as a gift to a famous natural philosopher, George Benham. She's sent into Benham's household to work as a maid, but as soon as she arrives, she is struck by an instant and fierce attraction to his wife, who is an enigmatic French woman named Marguerite. The pair of them embark on a very twisted Gothic love affair, which ends in tragedy because Benham and Marguerite are found murdered. Benham stabbed to death in his library. Marguerite in her bed with Franny lying next to her covered in blood. And so suspicion falls on Franny. She's brought to trial at the Old Bailey. And her barrister essentially says to her, you know, give me something I can save your neck with. And at his insistence, she writes her confession, which takes the form of the novel.
All of them swollen into the same mood, all of them in a stir about the sensation excited by these most ferocious murders. Those were the words of the Morning Chronicle, itself in the business of harvesting that very sensation, like an ink-black crop. I don't make a habit of reading what the broadsheets say about me, for newspapers are like a mirror I saw once in a fair near the Strand that stretched my reflection like a rack, gave me two heads, so I almost didn't know myself. If you've ever had the misfortune to be written about, you know what I mean.
She's recounting her life story, but what she's really doing is trying to convince herself, as much as the reader, that she couldn't have done this terrible thing, in particular that she couldn't have murdered the only person she ever loved. But the problem is that she has no memory of the incident, she claims, apart from being asleep.
Now, it's described as historical fiction, a whodunit, but at its heart, it's really a Gothic novel.
Yes, and it was my way of tapping into a kind of reading vein that I had felt very strongly connected to since my very early reading days. So I was obsessed with Gothic novels as a teenaged reader. And the books I read and reread during my early teens were the twisted gothic romances like Wuthering Heights and Rebecca. And I really wanted to write this novel as a tribute to that early reading love, you know, way of writing the kind of novel I would have wanted to read, but putting a black woman center stage in one of those novels where I'd never seen one before. And it was also a very deliberate tribute to Jane Eyre, which is one of my all-time reading loves. While I've been on book tour, I've taken to describing the novel as Jane Eyre if Jane had fallen in love with the madwoman in the attic and then been accused of murdering Mr. Rochester, which I think is a fate Mr. Rochester deserved, but that's probably for another discussion.
Now, Franny mentions the book she's reading, but her and yourself, you would never see yourself in any of those books.
Yes, Franny says this. She also says at some point that no one like her had ever written a novel in the history of the world. When I wrote the novel, I was very conscious of what an incredible privilege it is to be able to read and write, in particular to be able to tell stories and to put yourself into stories, and how the reality during the early 19th century would have been that someone like Franny would have been deprived of that. And part of the novel explores the price that she has to pay to, you know, to acquire this education. So growing up in the plantation, she is given certain privileges and advantages. She's brought to work inside the house. She's allowed to learn to read. And then there is this consideration of what that means for her. And she says it's the best thing and the worst thing that had ever happened to her. I really wanted to explore that, to talk about how it might feel to love books and learning so much, but to have that thing you love not quite love you back. So it opens the door for her to this world where she doesn't belong. And as a result, she experiences the kind of anger and dissatisfaction of the disenfranchised. You know, it's quite a familiar feeling, I think, to people whom history has tried to exclude and whom literature has tried to exclude.
It sort of reminded me, in a way, just in the structure of His Bloody Project, which was shortlisted for the Booker a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And the body of the text is written by the accused giving their own account.
Yes, and there are artifacts as well, so extracts from the trial. It's also a book, I suppose, that centres around a trial. Also centres around the question, not only whether or not the accused did what they did, but whether there could be any justification if they had done it. I wanted to focus very much on the trial for a number of reasons. I mean, I have a background as a lawyer, although I was a lawyer who always wanted to be a novelist. So I approached the profession in that way. But I really did want a big courthouse scene. I think, you know, courthouses are the places where some of the big dramas of life are played out. So it's no surprise that novelists kind of mine that for material. And because I was writing about, at times, quite heavy and important topics, I wanted the trial and this sense of jeopardy to provide a kind of page-turning character to the book. You know, I always think that reading should be good for us, but first and foremost, it should be pleasurable. And I wanted that feeling of anticipation and suspense that drives the reader through the novel. Not that they're being taught something, but that they desperately want to know how something turns out. And so it seemed to me that having the trial and having these kind of extracts from the testimony interspersed through the novel would kind of amp up the tension, which is what I wanted.
Even those old hacks who've seen it all want a glimpse of the mulatta murderess. Even the judge stares, fat and glossy in his robes, his face soft and blank as an old potato, until he screws his eyes on me and nods at his limp-haired clerk to read the indictment.
Francis Langton, also known as Ebony Fran or Dusky Fran, is indicted for the willful murder of George Benham and Marguerite Benham, in that she, on the 27th day of January in the year of our Lord 1826, did feloniously and with malice aforethought assault George Benham and Marguerite Benham, subjects of our Lord the King, in that she did strike and stab them until they were dead, both about the upper and middle chest, their bodies having been discovered by Eustacia Linux, housekeeper of Montford Street, London. Mr. Jessop to conduct the prosecution.
And there was a real-life inspiration in that a child was given as a gift.
Yes, so the springboard for the novel was the story of Frances Barber, which I first came across in a wonderful biography written by Michael Bundock. And Frances Barber was a young Jamaican boy who was brought to England in the middle of the 18th century and given as a gift to Samuel Johnson, you know, one of the finest minds of the age. And a couple of things surprised me and intrigued me and immediately attracted me about it, not least the fact that there were so many rich stories about black people in London, you know, in early Georgian London, and not just with the Windrush, which is a misconception, but also the idea that you could have this young, intelligent Jamaican boy rubbing shoulders with one of the finest minds of the age. And I really wanted to think about that a little bit. Usually we come at black characters in historical fiction from a different perspective. I wanted to think about what these almost familial relationships would be like. You know, as Franny says, there was love as well as hate, but the love hurt worse. So many black people in particular who were brought to London were living very, very closely with their masters and mistresses. And there was a kind of love there, but in many ways, a very destructive, one-sided love. And that was the angle I wanted to come at it from.
And were the experiments that you found out about, were they real as well?
Yes. So all of the experiments that I refer to have their roots in something that I discovered in my research. I didn't invent any of it, and I didn't want to because it was horrific enough. In fact, there were some things that were so gruesome that they had to be left out. So I allowed myself, you know, very little room for imagination there. It was all based on research, things that were recorded by real planters in the West Indies or people who were sort of journeying the earth, collecting skulls and various other bits of knowledge from far-flung parts of the planet, essentially.
All taking place in your novel in a place called Paradise.
Yes, ironically called Paradise. and part of the intention behind that was to expose this hypocrisy, you know, that this was the age of the Enlightenment, and there was this sense that mankind was making more progress more quickly than it ever had done before, you know, sort of heading towards utopia. But all of that progress was being built on the backs of people who really suffered on plantations like Paradise, and their stories were either discounted or heavily edited or told with agendas or not told at all.
Now, we heard at the beginning a clip of you reading from the book. How was the recording of the audio version?
Well, I do sort of jokingly say now that I regret having said yes to that. It was quite an experience. And I say it only jokingly because it ended up being a really enlightening and fun experience for me, but one that I found really difficult to begin with. First of all, because I had left the book behind, and in order to record the audiobook, I had to approach it from a completely different perspective. Ironically, I had to immerse myself more in the emotion of the book, performing it for the audiobook, than I did while writing it. I felt while writing it that I could keep some distance from events which I was manipulating, essentially making things happen. In the audiobook, I was almost experiencing in the way that I suppose a method actor would experience. And so it made it much more difficult for me. And then also, you know, there's just the fact that I'm not a trained actor. So I did feel, at times, I did feel this sort of sense of self-doubt about whether or not I could do it. But in the end, it ended up being a really rewarding process and, you know, particularly fun to go into the Penguin Studios and record with Roy McMillan there.
We mentioned Windrush in passing there, and I remember back in the day chatting to Andrea Levy about recording the long song and trying to find the voices of our parents. How did you find the voices of your past?
That's a good question. I didn't realise that Andrea Levy had recorded the long song. Mm. I must go and seek that out. I was very... I had a huge sense of trepidation about recording, in particular the accents in my novel, because I didn't want to get any Jamaican accents wrong. I'm the child of Jamaican immigrants, and we left Jamaica when I was 4. So the one thing I was very aware of was that if I produced any dodgy-sounding Jamaican accents, then I would be laughed out of the country the next time I tried to visit, and my parents might disown me. It's interesting what you said about Andrew Levy, because I tapped into the only source I have, which is my family, my grandparents, my parents, you know, the way I heard them speak growing up and the way I heard people around me speak growing up. I just tried to tap into that and also hope to forgive myself and to be forgiven if I got any of it wrong.
Now, one thing that we do miss if we download the audiobook version is the cover itself. Could you describe the embroidery on there?
Yes, the embroidery is based on an original piece of embroidery which was commissioned by Penguin from Scott Heron. And it is essentially an elaborate kind of bed of roses and skulls and bees and other Gothic imagery embroidered on a scarlet background, which I think really evokes the sense of richness and lushness, but also kind of simmering underlying terror and danger of the book as well.
And of course, it's now available in audio, making it accessible for a whole audience of blind and partially sighted people. Is that important to you?
Absolutely. I'm so delighted. First of all, I'm delighted to be doing this program and also delighted that the book is available in formats that can be accessible by blind and partially sighted people, you know, including many friends of mine who I know have accessed the book in audiobook form. So, yes, I couldn't be more delighted. And I hope that people who do listen to the audiobook will enjoy and appreciate it as well.
So congratulations on the first novel award.
Thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
The Confessions of Franny Langton, written and narrated by Sarah Collins, is out now wherever you buy your books.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show, looking back on the last year in books. Someone else who's won the Costa First Novel Award is Stuart Turton. His dazzling debut, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, was a blend of Cluedo, Quantum Leap and Groundhog Day. And his follow-up, The Devil and the Dark Water, is no less mind-bending, as he told me when we spoke in September.
So it's set in 1634 on a boat, a merchant ship that's travelling from Jakarta all the way over to Amsterdam on an 8-month voyage. But they set out to sea, and there's a motley list of passengers, as with Seven Deaths, my first book. I like a big ensemble cast, and this one's got the world's greatest detective in this period and his sidekick, and they're very sort of Sherlock Holmes and Watson duo. It has a noble woman with a secret. It's got her assorted family, her husband, who's this terrible man. He's a governor general of the place they've just left. It's got the captain. It's got the crew. Lots of different characters interacting, and everyone's got a secret. And they get on this ship, and they set out to sea, and then devilry begins to blight the voyage. So strange markings appear. Animals are butchered. Occult symbols begin to appear everywhere. And eventually, as there always is in my books, there's an impossible murder. Thankfully, as I said, there's a Sherlock Holmes character on board who could solve it, but he's shackled up, he's in chains, and you don't know what for, and nobody else does. But it's left to his Watson-style sidekick to solve the mystery in his stead, and that's kind of where the book kicks off. But then, as with Seven Deaths, like that concept belies a lot of twists and turns, and it jinks a few times and keeps slightly shifting genre as it moves along. So it's a lot of fun, I hope.
And you really capture the claustrophobia, the smells, the rather fetid atmosphere on board a long sea voyage. It actually felt very claustrophobic just reading that detail.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, I love detail in my books. Like, I love trying to get the reader as deep into that experience as they possibly can. I want them to sort of feel what my characters are feeling, and I want it to be a visceral experience. A lot of that came out of the research. It's based on a real boat, I should say, from a real shipwreck that happened in 1629. But they've rebuilt the boat that was wrecked, and you can go and visit it. It's in a port called Lillestad in Amsterdam, near Amsterdam. And it's a full replica, it works. They set it out to sail occasionally. And you can walk around it and sort of explore it at your own leisure. So I went out there and spent a weekend sort of pottering around that boat. And the first thing I noticed, because I'm 6'2", was how often I couldn't sort of unfurl myself in any part of the boat unless I was on deck. It was just too tight and too narrow. And I started reading accounts of the passengers, and it didn't matter who you were, it didn't matter how much money you would have. This journey would have been incredibly uncomfortable and unpleasant. And obviously, the poorer you were, the worse it would have been for you, because you would have been in a worse part of the ship. So it was really easy for me just to sort of begin to imagine this experience out to sea once I'd been on the boat. And as I say, like, I was really keen to make everybody as comfortable as I'd been.
And your detective, Sammy Pipps, is, as you say, rather perversely locked up and unable to do a huge amount of detection other than in his head, and it's left to his Watson-like sidekick. Aaron's Hayes to do all the footwork.
Yeah, you say perverse, that is the right word. It's because I grew up reading Agatha Christie, and when I read Christie, went through that back catalogue, I moved on to Sherlock Holmes. I was reading Sherlock Holmes when I was about 12, and I just didn't fall for them. I didn't fall for those stories in the same way I'd fallen for Agatha Christie stories. And the reason I didn't is because of Sherlock Holmes as a character. I just never warmed to him. I never liked him. And I realised that was part of it. But it was that all these characters around him were just like always lauding him. He's like heroic and noble. He's none of these things. Everyone seemed to think he was amazing. But he only ever solved cases that were intellectually interesting to him. He never just helped anybody because it was nice to help people. He treated Watson like he was a stumbling buffoon. But Watson was a doctor. Like, he was a very intelligent man. He'd been to war. He was a hero. And everybody acts like he's a nincompoop. Then you've got Lestrade, who runs the world's foremost policing unit at that time, Scotland Yard. And he couldn't find a cat up a tree. It's bewildering. So I always had a problem with those things. And I think when I came to write the book, it kind of made sense to me to sort of like rectify the things that I hadn't liked about Sherlock Holmes. Because I love the actual stories. They're always more adventures than cerebral mysteries like Christie. There's usually a quite good solution, but generally it's a lot of dashing around and pistols being waved in the air and Sherlock Holmes boxing, or there's like tons of these like things going on. And I wanted all of that. I just wanted to sort of sort out my feelings towards Sherlock. And I did that by locking him up effectively and humbling him.
Aaron Hayes howled in pain as a rock slammed into his massive back. Another whistled by his ear. A third striking his knee, causing him to stumble, bringing jeers from the pitiless mob who were already searching the ground for more missiles to throw. Hundreds of them were being held back by the city watch, their spittle-flecked lips shouting insults, their eyes black with malice. "Take shelter, for pity's sake," implored Sammy Pipps over the din, his manacles flashing in the sunlight as he staggered across the dusty ground. "It's me they want." Arendt was twice the height and half again the width of most men in Batavia, including Pipps. Although not a prisoner himself, he'd placed his large body between the crowd and his much smaller friend, offering them only a sliver of target to aim at. The Bear and the Sparrow, they'd been nicknamed before Sammy's fall. Never before had it appeared so true. Pipps was being taken from the dungeons to the harbour, where a ship waited to transport him to Amsterdam. Four musketeers were escorting them, but they were keeping their distance, wary of becoming targets themselves.
"You pay me to protect you," snarled Arendt,
wiping the dusty sweat from his eyes as he tried to gauge the distance to safety.
"I'll do it until I can't anymore."
The harbour lay behind a huge set of gates at the far end of Batavia's central boulevard. Once those gates closed behind them, they'd be beyond the crowd's reach. Unfortunately, they were at the tail end of a long procession moving slowly in the heat. The gates seemed no closer now than when they'd left the humid dampness of the dungeon at midday.
You have the most amazing narrator. You have managed to get Julian Rhind Tutt to read the novel.
It's just fantastic. He narrates so many great crime books, which just kind of puts me in that company, which is just lovely. For me, my most confident part of writing a book is the day before I actually start writing, getting that blank page. And then every day after that, I get less confident in it until it finally comes out. And I think that's just weirdly my process. So things like that, like, you know, narrators of that quality are just, they're just so helpful to get me believing in the book again.
Stuart Turton, thank you.
The Devil and the Dark Water is out now in print, ebook, and of course, that fantastic audiobook version narrated by the inimitable Julian Rhind Tutt.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show. One of the few nice things about lockdown is how people came together creatively and supported each other. And there's no more shining example of this than the recording of The Tin Ring.
The RNIB Library is passionate about making books accessible for blind and partially sighted people. And if a library user has a suggestion for a book that they would like to go into the library is always happy to hear their suggestions. One such book is The Tin Ring, The Astounding Story of Zenka Fantlova,
a survivor of the Holocaust. But who was going to record the book? Well, that is where my guest comes in. Anne Racklin is an internationally renowned music communicator, performer, lyricist, and author, who is also a friend of Zenker's. And, as we'll find out, when she heard that there wasn't a talking book version of The Tin Ring, she swung into action. She joined me from her home in Sussex.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Zenker's story is one of tragedy, hope, and survival. She was sent to 6 different concentration camps and survived Belsen. And the tin ring refers to a gift that she was given by her first love.
That's right. She fell in love with Arno, and it was a very deep love. And her fear was that they would be deported to different camps, but they first went to Terezin, Theresienstadt, and did meet up there. But sadly, quite soon after they'd met up, Arno was put on a transport to the east. The words transport to the east were really just meant Auschwitz and the gas chambers. They didn't know anything about that at all. But one night she was asleep and she was woken at 4 in the morning. Somehow or other, he'd managed to get into the women's block and she found him standing over her. She was sleeping. She woke up and he said, "We're leaving in an hour and I've made this ring for you." And he'd taken an old tin can and he'd made a tin ring and he'd carved on the inside Arno and the date. And he put it on her finger and he said, "This ring will save you. This is our engagement ring. And after the war, if we both survive, I will find you." And it was the tin ring from Arno that kept her spirit alive. For she was convinced that he would survive and that they would meet. And all the family would go back to the home in Czechoslovakia and go back to normal. Sadly, none of that happened.
She lost everything apart from that tin ring.
Yes, she had no one. Every single member of her family was killed by the Nazis. Her sister died in the camp. Her brother was shot trying to escape. Arno was shot. Her father died on a death march. And her mother, on arrival in Auschwitz, went, as they put it, up the chimney. So she found herself after her liberation in Sweden, and she was so looking forward to finding their names on the list of survivors, but not one was there. And all she had of Arno was the tin ring.
Zenker wrote the book, but until recently, it had never been made into an audiobook. And I believe it was one of our RNIB volunteers who requested that the book be made into a talking book. But then, how did you get involved?
Well, that RNIB volunteer was assigned to me and my partner because we're both 86 and he has Parkinson's. And so in lockdown, the local parish council very kindly thought we might need some help, prescriptions and food and all that sort of thing. And Terry, this wonderful man in Rye Harbour, rang up and asked if he could be of any assistance. And I told him that we were well looked after and I was sure there were many other people in greater need, but it was lovely of him to ring. And he said, "Well, I'll call you again in a couple of weeks just to make sure everything's still all right." When he called again, it was just at Easter, and at Easter it coincides every year with Passover. And when I mentioned Passover, the volunteer, Terry, said, "You know, there's one thing I've always wanted to do, and that is go to Auschwitz, but I'm blind. And I would need someone very sensitive and caring, a sighted person, to go with me. And I haven't yet found that person." And that led to me talking about Zenker, because Zenker has a personality that is so positive. and her attitude is so wonderful. She bears no malice. She's just an extraordinary person. And I mentioned the book, The Tin Ring, and he said, oh, I'd really love to read it. And I assumed he meant he wanted to have a copy of the book and perhaps his wife would read it to him. But a few days later, he rang me up and said, I'm really so disappointed. The RNIB don't have The Tin Ring in their library. They're thinking of getting someone to do it, but at the moment, I might have to wait quite a while. And we continued to talk. After that call, it was my time to ring Zenka. And when I rang her, she was very, very frail, and she was on a down day, quite understandably. And I said, how are you? And she said, frail, I feel so weak. And I thought, I must cheer her up. I said, do you know, I've got some really good news. The RNIB, the Royal National Institute for the Blind, are going to record your book, The Tin Ring. And I heard myself saying, and I'm going to record it for them. And she picked up, her voice became strong. She said, oh, that's the most wonderful thing. You've made my day. And then the phone call ended and I thought, oh my goodness, what have I said? Well, I am a recording artist, mostly for children. And I thought, how better could I spend lockdown than recording The Tin Ring for Zenka and for the RNIB and all its people and members? I thought I could do nothing better. I'm too old to go out and volunteer. I wouldn't be allowed to leave the house, but I can volunteer to do this. And by recording it, I will put people in touch with the most wonderful person who gives hope. Because, Red, what is important about The Tin Ring? It's not a book based on horror. Of course it's harrowing, and of course it's sad. But basically, it's a love story. It's a story of hope. It's a story of encouragement. It's a story of how to cope in the most dire circumstances and how to deal with the sort of thing that we're looking at now, but far, far worse. What she suffered was truly unbelievable. I know the story. I've heard her talk. I've taken her places to give talks. I know the story very well. I've read the book probably 3 or 4 times. But when I recorded it, the spoken voice, recording it aloud, brought me to tears. Many times I had to stop in order to continue. But at the end, I felt that wonderful surge of admiration and happiness that this woman is now 98 years old. She's waiting to get the card from the Queen. She said, I'm hanging on for that. And she will, because she's got the most wonderful sense of life. She says, and I think it's one of the most important lessons from the book, that all of us have what she calls a survival kit deep, deep inside us. We don't know it's there. And we never find it unless we're faced with something really dire. And then we can call upon it and we can bring it to the surface. And that's what made Zenka Fantlova so strong. And the end of the story is very, very uplifting. But this was challenging because previously I've always recorded in a proper recording studio with a sound engineer. I had to build a studio to do The Tin Ring. My daughter, fortunately, is a recording artist, and she travels, and she's built her own makeshift portable studio. And she taught me how to do it, and I bought all the things that were necessary. And I built the studio and went up to a room over my garage with my microphone inside a box with special audio foam. And that's how I've recorded The Tin Ring. Challenging, but I love a challenge, Red.
Thanks again to Anne Rackland for the wonderfully generous gift that she's giving to the RNIB Library. And please don't forget that the RNIB Library is funded entirely by charitable donations. So if you'd like to make a donation or find out how you can get involved in fundraising, why not contact the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Many people were wondering what to read to gain some insight on being stuck inside. And the RNIB Library's Lynn Livingston had the perfect suggestion.
In these times of lockdown, one thing that we all have more of is time to sit down with a good book. But I wanted to find a book that really chimed with the mood. So where better to go than Lynn Livingston at the RNIB Library for a great recommendation? Lynn, how are you getting on?
Oh, we're doing just fine, thanks. The library's running along quite happily, so busy as ever.
Have you picked up anything recently that you've really enjoyed?
I actually decided to revisit a book that I read a couple of years ago. It's one of my favourite books I have ever read in my entire life. And the reason I decided to go back and reread it was it seemed very appropriate for our times. The story is called A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. And the reason it's so appropriate is it's about a gentleman who is in lockdown in a hotel in Russia for over 30 years. It starts in 1922 when Count Alexander Rostov, who is a white Russian, is declared a non-person by the Communist Party in Moscow. And instead of being shipped off to a gulag in Siberia, they actually allow him to remain under house arrest in the Hotel Metropole where he is staying. And it's in the centre of Moscow. So he's right in the centre of this busy city, but all he can do is look out of a window and see it from afar. Over the next 30 years, as the world changes outside his tiny garret window, we keep him company. And what he does, in fact, is create a world for himself within the hotel. And what's so very special about this book is that it shows that the smallest of lives can also be the most full lives if you fill them with the right people. There's a real kindness to this book. It's full of connections made between people of all ages, nationalities, beliefs, which blossom over time into something wonderful. The Count actually creates this incredible life for himself through his openness and his willingness to befriend those he would not have otherwise met on the outside. It's a very open-hearted book. Gradually we see this man turn his confinement into pure gold as he and we realise the simple joys to be had in life, the taste of honey flavoured with summer flowers from far away in the country, the sight of stars after a long period of time without them, a game with a child, watching those we love grow into adults. It's a book of gentle moments of adventures that seem to lead nowhere. And even when nothing much is happening, it's such a delight to spend time in the Count's company. But the best thing about it is, however, that all these carefully laid trail of character-filled moments coalesce into the most glorious and triumphant ending. So all the little pieces are jigsawed together and you see where it all leads at the end. It's a book which I will come back to many times in my life. It's simply glorious. It reminds you of the joys of friendship, of love, and the sheer joy of just being alive. It's an incredible book and I would recommend anyone to read it and find those small moments of joy in their own lives. The book is available in Talking Book on TB23963 and also available for download from the Reading Services platform.
And it's beautifully narrated by Leighton Pugh, who we recently had as a guest on Read On and who has very fond memories of reading the book. Lynn Livingston, thank you so much for what sounds like a perfect book for our time.
Thank you. And everyone stay safe and keep reading.
For more information, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Thanks as ever to Lynn Livingston.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is a Read On retrospective of 2020. And now, before we hear the books of S.D. Robertson's life, let's head back to the summer.
Sarah Morgan's books have been described as comfort reading at its best, and her new novel, Family for Beginners, should be the perfect tonic for anybody struggling to live in close proximity to their nearest and dearest. Here she is to discuss it and her life as an author.
I write relationship novels, really, and I wanted to write a sort of complicated romantic relationship and also a complicated friendship. And in Family for Beginners, my heroine falls in love with Jack, which is lovely, but Jack is a widower who has two daughters, including a slightly difficult teenager, Izzy, who certainly doesn't want a replacement mother. So Flora has to navigate very choppy waters, and then Jack invites her to join them on their summer holiday with his dead wife's best friend, which is something that they've always done every year, and he wants the children to have the same routine and not disrupt anything. But it means that Flora is then facing the challenge of her life because she's trying so hard to fit in and be what she thinks they need her to be, and she's sort of losing sight of who she really is. So it's a sort of complicated relationship and also an exploration of complicated friendship, but it's upbeat as well, lots and lots of humour, a beautiful setting. It's set in the Lake District, which is one of my favourite places. So many happy family memories for me. So yes, it was a joy to write. I do like to set novels in places I'd like to be, because obviously I'm there while I'm writing it in my head. So I like it to be somewhere that I'd really like to be in person.
And that really comes through in your rich descriptions of the landscape, the natural beauty of the Lake District. And it was like stepping outside of my house and going back to a place that I've enjoyed myself.
Yes, lovely. It's a wonderful spot, isn't it? A wonderful spot. I think it's just unbeatable, really. And I've been fortunate enough to go to many places, but I can't think of anywhere more beautiful.
The relationship tension amongst people who all fundamentally love each other but irritate each other because of the artificiality of the situation that they find themselves in is perfect for these times.
Indeed, indeed. Trapped together. That's what this book is, really. They're all trapped together by the lake, and they're all trying to do their very best and contorting themselves into different shapes to please the other people. And it just becomes a bit exhausting after a while, and your own personality has to occasionally burst through. So that does bring some moments of humour and tension. But yes, you're right, particularly appropriate for the current times.
Well, as you say, it's very funny, and it's also very hopeful as well, that out of tragedy people can forge new and loving relationships if they just take a little bit of time to step back and meet people halfway.
I hope. My books are always hopeful. I always do say, even now, you know, a reader said to me the other day, I'm loving this book, but I am wondering, will it end happily? And I said, my books always end happily. That's 100% guaranteed. It is a hopeful book, because I think I'm a very hopeful person, really. And none of us know what's coming round the corner. But I think all you can do is keep putting yourself out there and doing the very best you can, which is what my heroine is doing, you know, because I suppose every relationship requires a degree of bravery. And it does require you to put yourself out there. That's what my hero is doing. But it's also what my heroine's doing, because she's always longed for a close family relationship and she wants that very badly. So she's sort of contorting herself in order to try and fit in. But yes, it is very hopeful. It is hopeful. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we won't always be locked in our houses, Red.
Yes. You also reminded me that having a flouncy teenager is perfectly normal.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And I think, you know, I hope that one thing my books do is reflect real life. I think people, in fact, I know they do, because I have people writing to me saying, gosh, you know, I really identified with that particular story, or I have people saying that a particular story helped them see things in a different way. So I hope that there is a real element of reality and reflection of real life in it. Though, of course, everybody is individual, and the way they handle things, the choices they make are all individual. But yeah, my books are hopeful and, yes, real.
We're lucky enough to have a wide selection of your books as talking books in the R&IB library. But then I went off and did my research, and you've written over 80 books, which is staggering.
Yes, my publisher tells me actually that I have now hit 90. And I have to say, I didn't realise that. I gave up counting a while ago. But, you know, I have been doing this for a long time, and I started off writing medical romance many years ago. I used to be a nurse, and that was my entry into writing, the medical romance. So I wrote about 35 of those before I moved on to other things. I wrote those for Mills and Boone, and they were great fun. I really enjoyed them, and lots of my readers still read them and love them now. And in fact, funnily enough, many of those were set in the Lake District. I used to do a series that was related to mountain rescue and set in the lake. So it's not the first time that I've gone back there, although it is the first time in one of my longer novels. So yes, 90 books, apparently. That's a lot of work. No wonder I'm tired. I'm just kidding. I love it.
And you mentioned the series of mountain rescue books that you've written, and that you were a nurse. The NHS is at the forefront of all our minds at the moment.
Indeed.
Do you miss that time as a nurse? Did you consider perhaps going back and volunteering for the NHS?
Oh, I'm way too far for that. No one would want me. I haven't been a nurse for a couple of decades now. I've been lucky enough to be writing for over 20 years, so nobody would want me by their bedside. Do I miss it? I certainly miss the interaction and the caring side of it, but I still get that from my writing. I've got wonderful readers who communicate with me frequently, and they'll often say, you know, I was up all night with my really sick father, and your book really helped me. And I kind of feel like, in a funny sort of way, it's still a type of caring. It's difficult to explain. When I was a nurse, I think one of the things that I learned is that you cannot fix everything for everyone. You would really like to, but you can't. But the one thing that you can do is perhaps make a moment better. So as a nurse, you might be trying to make someone more comfortable, or reading to them, or holding their hand, just something to make that moment better. And I think as a writer, you're doing that too, because I can't fix lockdown for people now, but I can give them a book that might make an hour or two of lockdown go a bit faster. Or, you know, if they're going through a really difficult time with somebody in their family affected or ill, perhaps I can give them an hour where their mind is taken off it. And I think that's the same sort of principle. I don't miss the frontline clinical stuff, because it's been a long time since I've done that, but I miss the interaction. But I still try and have that with my readers. I've got a very good interactive relationship with my readers. I'm very lucky like that.
And you're hugely popular with the R&IB library readers.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
We will leave with a clip of Family for Beginners, narrated by Catherine Fenton. And Sarah Morgan, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and for giving us a glimpse into your life as an author.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
The first time she saw him, he was standing outside the store, staring at the flowers in the window. His hands were thrust into the pockets of his coat, the collar turned up against the savage bite of a New York winter. It was the type of raw, freezing day that turned each breath into a white, puffy cloud, the sky moody and heavy with menace. People scurried past, heads down, going about their business with grim determination. Not this man. He didn't push open the door and seek refuge from the cold, as so many had done before him that morning. Instead, he lingered, a blank expression on his face as he scanned the array of blooms that splashed color over the monochrome of winter. Gilt flowers. Julia plucked 12 long-stemmed roses from the bucket and placed them on the workstation. He's going to buy gilt flowers. I bet you $10 he's had an affair, and he's looking at those flowers trying to figure out which of them says sorry in a way that isn't going to get him kicked out of the house.
Family for Beginners joins a wide range of Sarah Morgan's other books available in a full range of accessible formats from the R&IB Library.
And now, to round off this look back on a year where fact has felt stranger than fiction, here's an author who always seems to find hope in adversity.
In his first four novels, S.D. Robertson has built a reputation for writing emotionally intelligent stories that leave the reader appreciating what they have. And his latest book, How to Save a Life, promises to do the same. Its protagonist is forced to reevaluate his life after a near-death experience. Here's S.D. Robertson for the books of his life. Stuart, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, the book I would pick for that, and it was the first one that popped to mind, was Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce. I remember reading it as a boy, probably through school, and it just really resonated. And it probably would resonate with children now due to the fact that the main character is a boy in quarantine with his aunt and uncle after his brother gets the measles. He's not allowed to play out, and he's lonely without his brother or other children. And effectively, he discovers this sort of midnight world where there's this big garden that doesn't exist in the daytime. And it's just magical. Really, really fantastic book. Love it. And I read it with my daughter when she was growing up as well.
And yet, in spite of his assurance to Hattie, Tom continued secretly to consider the possibility of her being a ghost. For two reasons. Firstly, that there seemed no other possibility. And secondly, and Tom ought to have seen that this was the worst kind of reason, that if Hattie weren't a ghost, then perhaps that meant he was. Tom shied away from that idea. On the afternoon of the quarrel, he had been impressed, although he had been careful to hide this from Hattie, by her method of argument. She had a girl's quick eye for clothes, and she had used it on this occasion against him. Tom wished that he were able to do the same kind of thing, but he found that he remembered only vaguely the appearance of the people of the garden. He had, it was true, a strong general impression that they were not dressed like himself and his uncle and aunt, but old-fashioned was the nearest that he could get to the difference. Both Susan the maid and Hattie's aunt, for instance, had worn skirts nearly to the ground. Naturally, their clothes would be old-fashioned if Hattie were a ghost. Yet to prove her that, he must be able to put an exact date to the clothes in the garden, and so to Hattie herself. He thought he knew where he could find information. He had often noticed on his aunt's kitchen shelf, together with Mrs. Beaton's and all the other cookery books, a volume invitingly called Inquire Within Upon Everything. Now, when his aunt was out shopping, he slipped out of bed and borrowed it.
Elizabeth Proud narrating Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, that'd have to be The Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. Amazing love story, amazing way of dealing with time travel as a rare genetic condition, which I'd never encountered before. And as something unwanted rather than sought. And I just found it intensely moving and unforgettable. I believe there's a sequel in the works, which I hope is as good.
Saturday, December 22nd, 1991. Henry is 28 and 33. Henry. At 5:25 a.m., the doorbell rings, always an evil omen. I stagger to the intercom and push the button. Yeah? Hey, let me in. I press the button again, and the horrible buzzing noise that signifies welcome to my hearth and home is transmitted over the line. 45 seconds later, the elevator clunks and starts to ratchet its way up. I pull on my robe. I go out and stand in the hall and watch the elevator cables moving through the little safety glass window. The cage hovers into sight and stops, and sure enough, it's me. He slides open the cage door and steps into the corridor, naked, unshaven, and sporting really short hair. We quickly cross the empty hall and duck into the apartment. I close the door and we stand for a moment, looking ourselves over. Well, I say, just for something to say, how goes it? So-so. What's the date? December 22nd, 1991. Saturday. Oh, violent femmes at the Aragon tonight? Yep. He laughs. What an abysmal evening that was. He walks over to the bed, my bed, and climbs in, pulls the covers over his head. I plop down beside him. Hey. No response. When are you from? November 13th, 1996. I was on my way to bed, so let me get some sleep, or you will be sincerely sorry in 5 years.
Russell Bentley narrating The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, which is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, that'd be Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano, which is about a 12-year-old boy who's the only survivor of a plane crash in which his parents and brother die along with nearly 200 others. That's really, really good. Part coming-of-age story, part magnificent character study of a group of very different people all about to share the same terrible fate. Really recommend that.
When the Adler family reaches the front of the line, they load their computers and shoes into trays. Bruce Adler removes his belt, rolls it up, and slots it neatly beside his brown loafers in a gray plastic bin. His sons are messier, throwing sneakers on top of laptops and wallets. Laces hang over the side of their shared tray, and Bruce can't stop himself from tucking the loose strands inside. The large rectangular sign beside them reads, "All wallets, keys, phones, jewelry, electronic devices, computers, tablets, metal objects, shoes, belts, and food must go into the security bins. All drink and contraband must be thrown away." Bruce and Jane Adler flank their 12-year-old son, Eddie, as they approach the screening machine. Their 15-year-old son, Jordan, hangs back until his family has gone through. Jordan says to the officer manning the machine, "I want to opt out." The officer gives him a look. "What'd you say?" The boy shoves his hands in his pockets and says, "I want to opt out of going through the machine." The officer yells, apparently to the room at large, "We've got a male OPT. Jordan," his father says from the far side of the tunnel, "what are you doing?"
Cassandra Campbell narrating Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano, which is available from the RNIB Library. SD Robertson, thank you so much for sharing your love of books and the story behind your own books with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
You can find a full interview with SD Robertson alongside all of our past episodes by subscribing to the Read On podcast. Simply search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Alas, that's all we've got time for this year, but Read On will be back in its usual slot in 2021. Thanks to all my guests, to stand-in producer Hannah, who's worked tirelessly whilst Robert has had his broken ankle, and thanks, of course, to all of you for listening. Enjoy the rest of the Yuletide break, and let's all hope for a happy and healthy new year. Oh, and of course, don't forget to read on!